welcome to this week's edition of World. So, and this is Webster Tarpley here on World Crisis Radio, coming to you from Washington, D.C. And right now it's the afternoon of Friday, April 15th, the Ides of April, I guess. And we're still in the middle of this big election campaign, which is so full of portent one way or the other for the near future. Now, we want to keep our attention on the bungling, flailing loser Donald Trump. And again, nothing disgusts me so much as a fascist who whines and complains. If you want to be a fascist, you got to be somewhat ferocious, right? You got to be aggressive. You can't be always so preoccupied with yourself as a victim, right? The idea of the self as victim is very much the Anglo-American model of the last several decades, right? The fascist model is supposed to be different, but the poor guy just can't do it. He's falling short as a fascist, right? What kind of a fascist is this, with all the complaining and the bungling and the sore losing and so forth? So we want to keep our eyes on Trump, and we did. For example, yesterday evening, right now, again, it's Friday the 15th. So yesterday it was Thursday the 14th, and we had an excellent Tax Wall Street Party intervention right there on 42nd Street, right by the, I guess it's called the Grand Hyatt. It's the old Commodore Hotel right next to Grand Central Terminal. And we were there. We had a great team. We had that excellent poster that has been, that's been gone around the world many times now in film and video and photographs and so forth from that demonstration of yesterday. There's an operation called Complex News that has included our poster and one of our fine spokespersons in this the report that they gave about that anti-Trump demonstration. There were one or two very high-profile posters and people intervening along the idea that Trump is a fascist, a Nazi, a neo-Nazi, and so forth. And that is, of course, most welcome. And I also, I have to note this this character with one of those red baseball hats who was trying to bust into a demonstration that was against Trump, and he was trying to sell his own gun shop. And essentially, he was not welcomed. He was scorned. But as far as I could see, nothing much happened to him. I was amazed. But then as soon as he got across the street, he began whining that they took his hat and they took his sunglasses and all this other stuff. And this is so, so pathetic. Again, you want to be a fascist, fine, but stop with the yammering and the whining. This is just crazy. It's also not fine to be a fascist, but you get the idea. So that's Trump. But now we have, I think, some important things that are happening on the Democratic side. And we want to go through through those. We want to give a rundown on last night's Brooklyn debate. There in the old Brooklyn Navy Yard, right, where all those ships were built, place has been deindustrialized. It's now just there for services. So that's where Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders squared off yesterday. And I think we need to make some comments about this. We also want to note the principal issue in terms of formal policy questions that came out of this was the notion of the cap on the Social Security payroll tax. And we know that the libertarians, full of cynical nihilism, as libertarians are wont to be, those libertarians are always telling you that the social safety net is a fraud, it doesn't exist, you'll never collect, and so forth. And that is, of course, a big lie spread by those cynical nihilists of the libertarian persuasion. But the idea is that all you have to do is remove the cap on the Social Security payroll tax, by which I mean if you earn income, in other words, wages, tips, other compensation, you pay a Social Security payroll tax on that, right? 6.5-7%. And that goes up to $118,500. You pay that tax, right? And it's considerable. But if you earn over $118,500, you don't pay any more Social Security payroll tax on the amount over $118,500. Now, this is insane. First of all, why stop at $118,500? Right? We've gone through all those arguments, right? You're benefiting from the infrastructure of the country. You're benefiting from the government, from the foreign representation, from the national defense, from the police powers, from other forms of of assistance. So why not simply remove the cap? In other words, if you have wage income, you pay it all the way up. As much as you earn in wages, you're going to pay the 6-7% Social Security payroll tax. And if you just do that one thing, remove the cap, let those rich characters pay their fair share, then the Social Security system is solvent for 5 or 6 decades. In other words, the purview of anybody now alive is covered. So you're going to have Social Security as far as the eye can see. And then there is the question, of course, to raise the benefits, which we also support here. And that is to say, in 2007, 2008, because of the actions of the Wall Street hedge fund hyenas, zombie bankers, and other financial predators, financier oligarchs, a lot of people had their traditional 401k and IRA retirement income plans, their investment plans. Those were, in many cases, pretty thoroughly destroyed by the Wall Street hedge fund hyenas and zombie bankers, as we said. So that if you had planned, you know, you could have been saving for 3 or 4 decades or more and put money into those retirement plans. And then, of course, the stock market panic wipes them all out and you're left with very little. So there is this question, which I have raised in previous years. There is the question of increasing the Social Security payroll tax, the Social Security benefit, recognizing that a lot of people, a very large group, have been stripped of their pre-2008 savings and their pre-2008 retirement income, and that should be then essentially compensated for. In other words, people like that, if they're not going to be destitute and go to an early death, they're going to need additional income. Now, of course, my program for solving the problem of the federal budget is built, first of all, around the Wall Street sales tax, that is to say, a tax of 1% on all Wall Street turnover, all transactions, be they stocks, bonds, above all, derivatives. Certain kinds of derivatives are going to have to be outlawed, but as long as they're there, they can be taxed, and that includes credit default swaps, collateralized debt obligations, all kinds of options, indices, futures, all the combinations of those that are now so eagerly marketed, energy derivatives and so forth. We want to ban the energy derivatives too as time goes on. But you get the idea. So this was really the main policy issue that came up in the Bernie versus Hillary debate, and we'll be back in just a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So we're just rounding out this question. I want to do the policy part first, because then we got to describe the dynamics of this debate and what I think it tells us. The Social Security payroll tax should not be limited. It should not be capped at 118,500 for an individual and corresponding amounts then for other status, right? Married, jointly, and so forth. The Social Security payroll tax should not be capped. It should not be limited. It should be collected on all wage, tip, and other income, whatever you put in that top line on the front of your tax return. That should all be taxed for Social Security payroll tax. And with that, the future, the solvency of Social Security would be assured for 5 to 6 decades or more. And that, of course, would refute the entire demagogy of these libertarian, cynical nihilists who are telling you, listen, kid, don't think you're ever going to get any of those pensions. You'll never live to see it. They're going to strip it from you. Well, no, it's just not true. And it would essentially destroy a lot of their demagogy. So the cap should be removed. And then, of course, other parts of the federal budget need to be supplemented with a Wall Street sales tax, which is on all derivatives, all stocks, all bonds, except federal bonds probably accepted. But any derivatives, even if they're based on federal bonds, those are all going to be essentially taxed on the 1% Wall Street sales tax. So with that, you've solved the problem of the federal budget. But now the way that this came into the debate between Hillary and Bernie yesterday was the following. We, as you know, have been deploring here. The Tax Wall Street Party has officially deplored the lack of commitment by Bernie Sanders, in other words, his cowardice, his passivity, his refusal to fight. This was obviously, you know, seen in the very first debate back around October 20th, October 21st, the first Democratic debate in which Bernie said that he was not going to make an issue of Mrs. Clinton's emails. Well, her emails are an issue because it goes to this question of secrecy and high crimes against humanity. In other words, the assassination of Gaddafi, the destabilization of Egypt, the starting of the war in Syria. Those are things that Hillary Clinton did on her watch in 2010, 2011, 2012, when she was still in office. So it's wrong to say you're not interested. You're interested in the fact that Hillary Clinton had an email server that was created by her to avoid future probing under the Freedom of Information Act and other means, whether from inside the government or by the general public. She's trying to keep that stuff secret. So she's trying to be a warmonger and hide what kind of a warmonger she was. And when Bernie said, I'm not going to make that an issue, every intelligent commentator, and a lot of them have come forward, people like Chris Matthews and others, and maybe even O'Reilly, have come forward now saying, oh, we knew immediately when Bernie said that the damn emails were not an issue, we knew that he wasn't really a serious candidate. He was a placeholder. Well, some have called him a sheepdog, a kind of border guard, a gatekeeper, all these other things, that, you know, stalking horse in some cases. So all of that began to adhere to Bernie. Now, according to this New York Times article of 10 days ago, at some point, Bernie realized that he actually could win. And then he had to go to his campaign manager. I think his name is Jeff Weaver, if I'm not mistaken. They had to say, hey, we could actually win. Maybe we better start being more aggressive. So in the wake of that, in more recent months, we've heard Bernie coming forward and saying, I want to see the texts of your speeches to Goldman Sachs that you gave at $225,000 a pop. That's maybe what an average family would earn in 3 years, maybe 4 years for some. So there is interest in that, right? Was she promising them immunity? Did she say, we're going to make sure that none of you goes to jail for your crimes of the derivatives bubble of 07, 08, all these things? So he has, ironically, an issue that could have been really hard-hitting if he'd pulled it out last October. he has pulled out now on the campaign trail and not gotten the bang for the buck that he could have had. And we also, we condemn this attitude of Bernie Sanders that, he's going to hold himself above the fray. He's going to respect the code of the independent voter who is very fussy and doesn't like acrimony and wants everything to be civil and bipartisan and all the rest of this claptrap, right? The process questions. And our contention has always been, American people, if you really want to get them on your side, deliver the goods in terms of mass traction and economic issues. Forget about the process. It doesn't matter how much acrimony there is if the result is something positive for the country and indeed for the world. So Bernie has now somewhat come around, and he has dropped some of his fetishes, right? Some of his, really neurotic, I would say, complexes on mixing it up, right? Fighting, being more aggressive. Now, here's the thing. When you have these debates, you have to realize that the debates are limited in number. Last night in Brooklyn, Brooklyn Navy Yard, the Bernie Sanders-Hillary Clinton debate was the first one in many weeks. I'm not sure. I think about a month, maybe more. And it is not certain if there will be another debate. Now, of course, if you're in California or even Indiana, or you could be in Delaware, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, Maryland, you could say, well, we have regional issues too, and we do, right? Maybe we want to talk about the Chesapeake Bay, or we want to talk about the California drought and other questions, maybe in the Pacific Northwest and on and on. But it's very likely that Her Majesty Hillary Clinton will not be too interested in debates. So this might have been the last one. So what we were trying to do, we of the Tax Wall Street Party, as we went towards this Brooklyn debate, try to hammer Bernie's inner circle so they get the idea the way you have to approach these is the chance to deliver a knockout blow, a knockout punch, a KO, or at least a TKO, not to score debaters' points, but to actually do something. They call it a game changer. And let's see how that went when we come back here in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarp here in Washington, D.C. Once again, it's the 15th of April. So what we're discussing is the Bernie Sanders-Hillary debate at the Brooklyn Navy Yard last night, and the question of the confrontational challenge. And what we mean by this is the following. Hillary Clinton is an expert in evasion, prevarication. She's slippery, right? She's very hard to pin her down. But when you have her with you on the debate stage, especially if it's one-on-one in that way, you have the opportunity of boxing her in with a challenge, with a confrontation. And it generally takes the form of, I challenge you right here and right now, Hillary, in front of this nationwide audience, to come forward and say that you are going to publish the texts of your Goldman Sachs speeches. Now, that's one way to do it. Now, the best way to do it is to make sure that you're issuing a challenge, not so much on a process question, which these Goldman Sachs speeches are, right? That's the process of campaigning. And so those are important things. And you know, you can get a lot of mileage out of that, because some people get extremely upset about precisely such rather, process questions. But if you want to get something really of value, you have to set up a situation where you can issue a challenge and a confrontation, a peremptory challenge to the opponent on a mass traction economic issue, one that might even involve survival, life or death for working families. Now, We have been calling on Bernie to do this for months. Bernie, you've got to go for the knockout punch. Stop worrying about your fussy independence and knock her out of the race. And we went through some of those examples, right? These, some of these are not on mass traction economic issues, but the, I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was my friend. And Senator Quayle, you're nothing like Jack Kennedy. You're no new Jack Kennedy, this kind of thing. Where's the beef? Or there you go again, or what have you. These can be extremely effective. So the point was that Bernie should do this. Now, as the minutes ticked by in this debate last night, and we got into the second hour, and we got halfway into the second hour, we began to wonder, would Bernie be able to even make a gesture in this direction in what may well have been the last debate? We don't know that, but I'm sure if it's left up to Hillary, it has a good chance of being the last debate. So I guess in the last half hour, Bernie started to do this maneuver, except that he did it on the most idiotic of all propositions, and that was the carbon tax. The carbon tax. Yikes. The carbon tax, of course, is a very oppressive measure. It is a regressive tax. It weighs most heavily on the average working person who must use a car, typically fueled by gasoline, overwhelmingly, to get to work. So if you're going to tax carbon, this is a regressive tax that the rich parasite and predator will not notice, but the average working person will experience as extremely onerous. And then there's also the problem that it makes no sense, right? If you're worried about global warming, you're worried about the warming of the planet. We've always said on here, right, the Louisiana example, the answer to inundation is elevation. In other words, if you find that you are beset by specific symptoms of a warming, if that occurs, then you want to answer those directly, right? You take the road that would have been underwater and you raise it up and you've got your road. So the carbon tax is backward in all of these aspects. It is very, very bad policy. So Bernie made what I think we can say is a half-hearted attempt to go for the challenge confrontation maneuver with the carbon tax. And this would have been just so... I'm glad he didn't insist. I'm glad he dropped this. He was essentially distracted from it, and he didn't carry it through. And then, after that, he then tried it again. And I think, you know, you have to figure for him, this is a big leap compared to his usual, you know, passive, namby-pamby kind of campaigning style. This is a big deal. So he tried it on the carbon tax. Thank God that didn't go anywhere. And then he turned to this question of the Social Security payroll tax cap, which is currently set, as we said, at $118,500. And would Mrs. Clinton agree on the spot in the debate to lift the cap, to abolish the cap, and to then also commit to raising benefits, right? Not cutting them, but raising them. And we know that her desire is to cut them. She is an austerity Democrat. She is a Wall Street Democrat. She's going to be interested in what the Peter Peterson Institute has to say, right? Those austerity ghouls that want to strip you of your economic rights. So would she do that? And she attempted to evade, and she did evade to some extent. But I think anybody who watched that with eyes wide open saw that she is a liar, she's a prevaricator, and she's an austerity ghoul, which is worse than the first two, right? If you're an austerity ghoul, that's really bad. So the way she did it, of course, is to say, well, I think that might be one way to do it, but I'm not going to commit to that because there are other ways to do it, and those would be 1, 2, 3, 4. So she disappears in a cloud of options without having committed to anything. I think Bernie more or less managed it. In other words, he did show that she's not committed to making the rich pay what is, after all, their fair share on this very specific thing of the Social Security payroll tax. And, of course, if we were there, we would have said, get the Wall Street sales tax in addition to that, and then you'll have the entire – you won't be spending – your Social Security money on something else. You'll have the federal government fully funded. And face the fact that Wall Street pays no taxes. This is the main problem. Wall Street doesn't pay taxes. They don't pay them individually. We know Goldman Sachs pays either zero federal corporate income tax or negative. General Electric pays negative. In other words, they get money back and so forth. So, that's what went on. And she was evasive, but I think he made a significant effort, right? In other words, you could see there was an attempt by Bernie to use this method of challenge and confrontation. Again, we wish he hadn't waited until the last debate, or what may well be the last debate. And I would urge people, given this somewhat promising sign from Bernie, it's better now to have more debates. If you're in California, boy oh boy, should you demand a regional Western debate about all those Western issues and water issues and public land issues and all those other things. And if you're in Oregon or Washington, right, there's that whole thing in the beginning, the first weekend of June, I think it is, right? Similarly, if you're in Indiana, you know, and all these other places, there should be several more Democratic debates. Because we're finally getting at least some inchoate signs that something will happen. Okay? So we'll be back in a minute with more. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So that's the picture. Bernie made one half-hearted attempt on a completely misguided issue, but then he made at least a semi-serious attempt to go for the confrontation and challenge model with Hillary Clinton on this question of the Social Security payroll tax. And that's a good mass traction economic issue. And I'll tell you why. Because if you don't do this, and if you don't commit to lifting the cap and taxing wage income above $118,500 from $118,500 all the way to infinity. You got to tax every penny of that. That's the way you restore solvency. And why should the rich be shielded from the general welfare? The general welfare requires that this is one area where the rich pay their fair share. Right? And all the libertarian, cynical nihilists can scream, but it's simply that, right? Either you're going to have old people destitute, dying in the streets, as one demagogue put it recently, or you're going to start collecting that payroll tax. So that's a good one. Hillary, obviously, is an austerity ghoul. She's a Wall Street puppet. She's a warmonger. She wants to strip you of your New Deal economic rights, and the answer is don't let her do that. And if you ever get on stage with Hillary Clinton, you get her on this issue. And by the way, at that point, you follow up. You don't let go. You demand an answer. You demand an answer. You box her in. You track her down. You make her answer. And you have to brush aside these press characters. I don't know what to say about this, right? The CNN people were annoying beyond belief. Is of course just annoying that they were constantly interrupting, but then you eventually saw that there was a pattern that they were protecting Hillary Clinton because she's the one who has the most to lose from being followed up on, right? So once you pose this question, you gotta hold on tight and don't let go and make her answer the question. That would be the necessary technique. Because you're talking about people's lives here, right? I realize the independents, all those fussy independents, they don't like that acrimony. That's going to be too bad for them. What would they rather have? people dying in the streets, World War III, those are the issues. So the independents have somehow got to readjust, right? Whether the typeface is what they wanted, right? They've got to live in the real world. And a lot of them, of course, don't. They act as if they were theater critics on some of this stuff. Anyway, now, here's the other thing, though. This is now also another good reason why Hillary must never be president. Now, just to remind everybody, right, we're here at World Crisis Radio and the Tax Wall Street Party in general. The template we're working from is a political perspective, right? We have been saying for some years now that there was a very vast and very obvious potential for the Republican Party to destroy itself, to split into pieces. And this is what we're now seeing, right? We have the Trump faction of the Republican Party, and then we have the anti-Trump faction of the Republican Party, right? Both in the Republican Party, and they're fighting, and there are other splits going on, right? Between the donor class, these elite billionaires, Koch, Adelson, Mercer, we know them. They're in a kind of a contest against the crazed petty bourgeois base, because of course the elite donor class, they don't care about abortion, guns, God, gays. That's rube bait. Right? Those are the social issues that you've got to have in order to convince the various bigots and others to come out and vote for you. But of course, Koch doesn't care about that. Koch wants union busting, corporate welfare, deregulation, money. In other words, money, filthy lucre in many of its forms. So there's a big contradiction there. In other words, you've got a Republican Party where you have aging white population, and it's the less educated part of the white population, obviously. It's the people who have not been successful in the recent decades, right, under, of course, difficult situations. On the one hand, and then you've got this super rich group in Wall Street. Now, let me also say, I take seriously the grievances of the less educated white population, and we have always had a policy array that would actually solve their problems as distinct from acting out their rage. If you have a 15% protective tariff, permanent feature of a well-regulated, stable economy, so that nobody can come out of the corner with a surprise attack and dump a lot of merchandise and drive you out of business. The 15% is there, and it can be raised. But you've also got to have the repeal of the Taft-Hartley Act, in the sense of go back to the Wagner Act. We don't want any right-to-work states. It's got to be a human right, as it is, I think, on the UN Human Rights Charter. Collective bargaining, a union, those are basic human rights, and they are denied in the American South and now in Wisconsin and in Michigan. And you've also got to have then a living wage, right, the $15. Now, of course, Mrs. Clinton, even on the $15, she won't commit. She says, yes, I'd like to have a $12 federal wage, and then she's got other things. You can build all that into a piece of federal legislation, which gets you to $15 an hour within, say, 2 or 3 years at most. And that, I think, would be reasonable, right, that there'd be a gradual process. But you notice Hillary Clinton will not commit to a $15 minimum wage, even when challenged. And Bernie, I think he also challenged her to some extent on that. So there are some positive signs in all this. So that's those are some of the problems of this situation in the Republican Party. So you've got super rich donors and a bunch of again rural white disadvantaged people. And again, we have the programs needed to actually solve their problems if that's what they want. But a lot of them are beyond that. A lot of them are crazed. A lot of them just want to act out rage fits and so forth. And this leads then to Trump. So the Republican Party is going to break apart. The scenarios, I think, now are converging. You're going to have this convention in Cleveland, And if Trump gets the nomination, which I think is the most destructive and therefore in some ways preferred option, then 25-30% of the Republicans will either walk out immediately, or they will refuse to campaign for him, or they'll refuse to vote for him. They won't give him any money. They won't, be campaign workers and all that. And by the same token, if the nomination goes to Cruz or Kasich or somebody else, then the 25-30-40% maybe of Trump will essentially walk out and or boycott the candidate of the Republican Party and so forth. Remember, if you want to destroy the Republican Party root and branch, and we do, the way that happens is if Trump takes the nomination, and that is when he's going to drag into the abyss everybody else who's a Republican candidate for anything, be it Senate, be it House, be it Governor, be it State Legislature, be it County Executive, Mayor, whatever it is, all those Republicans all the way down the ballot will pay a heavy price. If it's Trump as a third party or Trump just as, somebody complaining off into the sunset, then that will also hurt the Republicans, but maybe not quite as much destruction, although it's hard to say. Again, my only proviso is if Trump gets to the Republican nomination, that is too close for comfort given the known failures of the Democratic Party when it comes to fighting. He might then become president, in which case we would be headed, I'm afraid, at least in the general direction of civil war. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome to the second hour of World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C., Friday the 15th of April. So, once again, we're looking at a party landscape where our forecasts, our prognostications are coming true. The Republican Party is splintering into two parts, right? It's going to be a sort of traditional conservative reactionary Buckleyite party, and then we've got the followers of the man on horseback, the Caesarist, the would-be dictator, the mountebank, the fascist, Donald Trump, right? And whether that Trump thing can stay together because of his lack of attention to organization, logistics, and detail is anybody's guess. But break it into two parts. That's the best thing that could happen to the world. And don't listen to National Public Radio, Mara Liasson, or somebody like this who says we need the two parties. No, we don't. We want to get rid of the Republican Party. They should disappear, and then we'll see what happens to the Democrats. So the Republicans are splitting. Now, we've always said that as soon as the Republicans dwindle to the status of a third party, a rural party, not a national party, in the South, in the Intermountain West, in rural America in general, you could have certain pockets of Republicanism, I'm sure, in the Deep South, the old Confederacy, things like this. They'll continue to be people calling themselves Republicans. But the big thing is they should not be able to elect a president, and they should not be able to dominate the Congress. And that has to happen now. We can't wait for eventual redistricting, because if you're going to control the redistricting, then that's got to happen now. And there should not be a permanent austerity dictatorship, which happens if these reactionary and fascist Republicans get to pack the Supreme Court with more lunatic fascistoid judges in the tradition of Scalia and generally the rats cabal that we've seen at work. Now, here's the thing, though. What we're seeing is the split of the Republicans goes on apace, right? We've got lots of Republicans now saying they will never vote for Trump, never Trump. I hope they mean it. I'm sure some of them do mean it, or I believe some of them may mean it, but you get the idea. It's going to be extremely acrimonious, and hopefully they fly apart, right? They bust up. So on the Democratic side, though, we're already seeing the second phase, which we've always talked about, which is that in the Democratic Party, there are really two parties. There's a Wall Street Republican Party, Democratic Party, Wall Street Democrats, Hillary Clinton, Chuck Schumer, Durbin, lots of people in the House and in the Senate, right, and governors, Wall Street Democrats, right? There are lots of them, too many to enumerate. But then you've also got this other group somehow, right? And this has now come to the fore around Bernie Sanders, although, again, I must be forgiven for not wanting to look at him really as a leader, but simply as a kind of detonator in a certain way, right? Doing everything he can to self-sabotage, because that's what he's done. But there he is, nonetheless, right? However half-hearted, however contradictory, there it is. And that's this faction of kind of progressive caucus, maybe New Deal leftovers, labor people in the House of Representatives, a few in the Senate, Bernie, again, Elizabeth Warren. These are leaders that are not really qualified to lead beyond a certain point, but in the interim, right, they're transitional figures. Bernie's a transitional figure. He could be very, very useful if he just learned how to do it right. So, what do we now see? The circle around Hillary Clinton, based on her performance in this debate, the circle around Hillary Clinton is interested in making a sharp right turn, a sharp reactionary turn by Hillary. In other words, worse than what you see is what you're going to get. Now, the way this is delicately phrased in the news is the people around Hillary Clinton are anxious to pivot to the general election. They would like to put Bernie away. They would like to put Bernie away and pivot to the general election and begin to, you know, deal with Trump. Yeah. But that is not just a question of what you say about Trump. Do you say that he's a dilettante, that he's a clown, that he's misogynist, that he's a racist? He's all those. But what Hillary is proposing to do goes far beyond this. Hillary is talking about a sharp right turn of her campaign and of the Democratic Party in general. I keep thinking of Poland after World War II, right? As we know, after World War II, it was like Poland got picked up and moved about 150 miles to the west, right? The Soviets took territory in the east, and Poland was compensated with German territory in the west. So Poland was just moved over. Now, you can see what's going on in the minds of Hillary's hench people, and of Hillary and Bill, the two of them, above all. They want to make a lunge. Now, let me credit the lunge. This is Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report, who I think has put this together in a very succinct and admirable way. Certainly the black community often acts as a kind of conscience, right? The first alarm bells go off there. So Glenn Ford and the Black Agenda Report write that Hillary's hench people want to make a lunge to the right, and they're really getting impatient. They don't want to wait until Bernie has been put away and capitulates and pledges that he's going to support the ticket, meaning Hillary. And the ideas are two. I say for myself, last night, the scorn and contempt, the angry posture of Mrs. Clinton vis-a-vis Bernie is, if you take it just in terms of the normal Democratic Party practice, is very ill-advised. Right? Hillary, you say, Hillary, you're a good demagogue. You know that you can't offend Bernie. You can't beat up Bernie. You're going to offend his supporters, and they'll never vote for you. They're going to hate you. They'll never come to you in November. And it seems to me maybe that's exactly what she thinks. I mean, she knows that, and she's doing it. So she's not making a mistake. She's carrying out a posture. So the idea is, Hillary, what you saw with Hillary last night was indeed something of a lunge to the right, even though Bernie is still there to challenge her. And what does she want? She wants the white Republican suburban vote. Let me repeat. The white Republican suburban vote. Now, this is not the poor white isolated, rural, vindictive, resentful, acting out, uneducated white vote that goes for Trump. This is now affluent, or at least comfortable, right? At least not hurting that bad. White, suburban, Republican vote. More educated, more money, horrified, to be sure, horrified by the fascism of Trump, horrified by the clerical fascism of Cruz, right? We haven't, you know, focused a lot on that, you know, theocracy and Christian dominionism and other insane things that Cruz has going on, but they're all there. So a lot of people can see that and say, my God, I can't vote for that. So Hillary and company are thinking to themselves now, all of those, these always comes up as the Philadelphia suburbs, right? All of those Philadelphia suburbs with all those white Republican suburban voters, says Hillary. She says, I'm going to grab them and I'm going to create a super party. The Democratic Party as super party, but it won't last. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Topley here in Washington, D.C. So, Hillary's lunge to the right, that anger, that scorn, that contempt that she showed in that debate with Bernie. Now, let's also go back, right? What the Black Agenda Report had noticed even before that was when Bill Clinton clashed with those black kids demonstrating for Black Lives Matter in a recent event, right? And you've seen it, right? Where they are complaining about the 1994 crime bill. And the 1994 crime bill is one element, maybe not the only one, maybe not even the biggest one, but certainly an element in the wave of mass incarceration of black male youth, young men, mass incarceration, and then the growth of the prison industrial complex on the basis of that. The draconian sentences, the discrimination built into the differentiation of crack cocaine from other kinds of cocaine and so on. All the obvious and well-known racially discriminatory in practice features of the 1994 crime bill. So they were there protesting that. And Bill Clinton, instead of being conciliatory and admitting that they had a real issue and that it ought to be changed and that he regretted it, because Hillary had said at an earlier point, right, when the primaries were just beginning, Hillary had said, yes, we regret the unintended consequences of the 1994 crime bill. As you saw, Bill Clinton, William Jefferson Clinton, got really angry and then said, why, you're arguing that those super predators who got kids high on crack and sent them out to kill the representatives of the other gangs, right? You're worried about Black Lives Mattering, and look what happened with these people, right? They were killing the lives you say are precious and matter. So there was also an element of scorn and contempt in that moment. So we put these together: the Hillary performance in the Brooklyn Navy Yard debate, plus Bill Clinton's rebuff, right? Brusque, angry, insulting rebuff, right? You don't have an issue. You should go home. That kind of thing. And it went on for quite a while. It went on for a quarter hour in his case. These things together seem to indicate that the Clinton campaign is obviously going to do this lunge to the right. Now, normally people would say, right, the cupboard says she's anxious to forget about Bernie and pivot towards the general election. Now, because everybody knows, in the primary, in the Democratic primary, you want to run to the left, and then you've got to navigate back towards the center. This is what was called last time around the etch-a-sketch moment, right? You can essentially pull up that piece of plastic and all your previous statements become inoperative, and you can now begin to reinvent yourself, right, as a centrist after being out there with some pretty radical stuff during the primaries. Now, but there's something more. what happens to Bernie, and indeed what happens to the black vote? Hillary had relied on the black vote during those primaries, and we were always here saying, hey, black voters in those southern states, why in God's name are you voting for Hillary Clinton? She's not going to do anything for you. As indeed, 8 years ago, you can find these speeches. Hillary Clinton was, since she was losing the black vote 8 years ago, she was out there saying that her supporters were hardworking white people. Wow. And she won Kentucky and West Virginia and these places, right, in the Democratic primary, beating Obama. So she was always very, very dubious. But now she obviously feels that she doesn't need those people anymore, and therefore she's going to take the right turn. So the idea is that Bernie and his group, and we have 25% of Bernie supporters say they will not vote for Hillary Clinton under any circumstances. And maybe the calculation is that that number is really larger. In other words, some of them vehemently say, now I'll never vote for her. It's probably more like 50% who either, you know, are adamant and vehement, and some of them will just say, you know, oh, I'm too tired, I'm not going to go vote. Who cares, right? It's Hillary Clinton anyway. I don't care about her. And so forth, right? So it may well be that 50 or 60% of Bernie's voters are already out of reach of Hillary. So you get the idea. It's a sharp turn to the right by the leading Wall Street Democrat and warmonger, as has been shown. And at that point, the black community is left out in the cold, the calculation being, who are they going to vote for? Trump or Cruz, right? That's crazy. The idea is they have no place else to go. They're going to come to Hillary, right? Especially because so many politicians, right? Black politicians have endorsed Hillary. So there's that. And then there's the idea, you know, Bernie's supporters are already beyond our reach, so we just don't care about them, right? And where are they going to go? They're not going to vote for Trump either. So the one ray of light in this is that they have tipped their hand, man oh man, with that Bill Clinton appearance and shouting down those black kids, and with Hillary's performance in the Brooklyn Navy Yard yesterday. This is a sharp right turn, and they're doing it too soon. Memo to Clinton campaign, right? If you want to be a successful demagogue, you got to wait until the primaries are over, as in over, before you make your move back towards the center, assuming you're going to do that, right, if you're going to be a demagogue. So you want to be a successful demagogue, you got to get the timing right, and they haven't. So they're now rather vulnerable. There's now a flank from our point of view. There's a big flank opening up on Hillary Clinton that she has miscalculated the times and the seasons, and that she has now shown us what she's going to be like, right? We knew from the email server that she would be secretive, and now we see that this is going to be a right-wing, warmongering, austerity Democrat, Wall Street Democrat regime. So what are you going to do? Well, the Tax Wall Street Party recommends in New York and the other states, right, coming up, but in particular in New York, this coming Tuesday, the Tuesday of the week here that we're talking to you, meaning Tuesday the 19th of April, vote for Bernie Sanders, obviously. Vote for Bernie Sanders. And in New York, stop Trump if you're a Republican. Stop him. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome to World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpon in Washington, D.C. So, sharp right turn by Hillary. The Tax Wall Street Party calls on everybody in New York State, vote for Bernie Sanders. He's made a little bit of progress. You can signal positive reinforcement by voting for Bernie Sanders. Not ideal, not a leader, not what we wanted, but as great realists and humanitarians, this is our recommendation. Right? Politics, unfortunately, it is dominated by absolutes, and certainly the Platonic forms dominate the playing field, but in terms of the actors you see on the stage, those are choices. They're not absolute. So you've got to relativize it. And then, of course, stop Trump. Vote for anybody that puts you in the best position in your congressional district or whatever it is to prevent Trump from getting delegates for the convention. And then the week after, of course, the 26th, it's going to be Maryland, Delaware, Connecticut. It's going to be Rhode Island. Pennsylvania comes soon after that. Same thing. Vote Bernie. Stop Trump. Stop Trump anyway you can with your vote. Right? Pick the vote that's going to cause him problems. Now, concerning Trump, this CNN production of Trump and the Family. I watched this. I was shocked. It took me back to the Cold War, because this portrayal of Trump and his family, and I will not waste adjectives on them, except to underline that I do not approve of this group of people. We always have to think of their victims, right? They're so charming, some of them, right? The children or whatever they are. But then you have to think of the 12 million human beings that he wants to deport, and how many tens of thousands will die in the course of that mass deportation, and what will that do to the United States? And that will be a permanent change. Don't kid yourself. That will not be a temporary phase. That will be secret police, Gestapo. Gestapo tactics will be used. There'll be steel cages at street corners in big cities with specimens of humanity screaming for mercy, mothers separated from their infants, and all the rest of it. That's what will go on here in the United States. So when you look at how charming the Trump family might be made to seem, think about the victims, like Scalia, right? Think about his victims before you start crying about Scalia. But what does this remind you of? Well, if you lived in Germany during the Cold War, as I did, there was this thing called DDR television, right? DDR television and their evening news broadcasts, and how they would portray the high personalities of the government and the party. Hohe Persönlichkeiten des Staats und Parteilebens in East Berlin, right? Erich Honecker, Honey, and Margot Honecker, his wife, and the people in the Politburo and so forth. Soviet television, quite similar. The one that I thought was closest to the CNN version was actually Romanian television. I was there in Romania in the early 80s. So this is under the dictatorship of Nicolae Ceausescu. And the form that this took was you'd get a worker, they'd show you a worker who has just doubled the quota, right? Produced twice as much as had been called for in his production quota or her production quota. Similarly with a peasant, a farmer, other kinds of people, right? All kinds of individual success stories in, going way beyond the quota, way beyond what had been established as a minimum target for them. And then they'd always be asked, how did you do this? This is amazing. And they said, well, I let myself be inspired by the shining example and inspirational figure of Nicolae Ceausescu, the head of the Romanian Communist Party. So this time around, it's Trump. This is unworthy of the United States, dear friends. This is a bad scene. So congratulations to CNN and Anderson Cooper and other propitiating bootlickers, frankly, for reviving the typical communist dictatorial pursuit on a television. And I'm sure I was never exposed to communist Chinese television under Mao, that is to say pre-75, pre-76, but there I'm sure this was even done, right? Because they would then hold up the little red book and say, yes, inspired by Mao Zedong thought in the little red book, I was able to do all these things. Now, Trump is whining. I guess, I think it was, who was it? Fran Drescher, one of these actresses on TV. She wrote her autobiography, and it was called Enter Whining. Well, Donald Trump could do with Enter Whining, right? Always whining. The loser, the stumble bum, Trump. always coming up with excuses, right? The bad workman blames his tools, and Trump is no exception, right? He won't take responsibility. He's a buck passer. Harry Truman, as I wrote up this week, you can see it in the Tarpley.net pages of the Daily Briefing. Harry Truman had this thing saying, the buck stops here, but not Trump. Trump is a buck passer. Trump is wonderful in passing on the responsibility and scapegoating other people. And it still comes down to this Colorado GOP caucus. Okay. The Republican Party of Colorado held precinct caucuses on March 1st. They were attended by 65,000 people. Anybody who was a registered Republican in Colorado could have gone to this. This was your chance. So at the precinct caucuses, rather like Iowa, you elect from the precinct caucuses, you get some delegates elected there who are going to go on to the county caucuses. Then you go to the congressional district caucuses, which are usually more than one county, although not necessarily, and finally to the state convention. And the state convention was just now in the first week of April. All of the complaining, scapegoating, whining, and carping of the Trump forces come down to nothing. That they blew it. He blew it. That's all we can say. Dear Donald, you blew it. Grow up, right? Poor little rich boy. Tell Daddy Fred that he's got to go and get you another ice cream cone. And, of course, one of the reasons Trump is the way he is, we shouldn't play around with these references, he was not loved. Fred Trump didn't love him. We found some interesting things about Fred Trump, right? The grandfather first. Remember that Trump's grandfather ran houses of prostitution in Alaska and the Canadian Yukon in the gold rush there, Alaska gold rush and stuff like this. Then we have Fred Trump, the father. Fred Trump, a Fred Trump, was arrested in Queens, in the borough of Queens, for disorderly conduct having to do with a Ku Klux Klan meeting, according to newspaper clippings. So a Fred Trump, how many are there going to be? And then we have the famous folk singer Woody Guthrie, who unfortunately for him ended up living in a room, where his landlord was Old Man Trump, 1967. Looks like Fred Trump there again. So somebody who was, hostile to popular interests, right? An enemy of the people. Let's put it that way. Somebody who was a predatory, oppressive landlord, you know the type. Somebody who was obviously at war with the New York City system of rent control and so forth. So that's Fred Trump. We'll have a few more choice tidbits about the Donald in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So, Trump, a couple of examples of what you have to do to recruit delegates. Now, this comes from some things that I've written in recent years. Let's see if we can find them. The idea being it takes a lot of work to get delegates and to keep them. Just a couple of examples. How did Richard Nixon bounce back to get the Republican presidential nomination and then indeed the presidency in 1968? As you remember, Richard Nixon had lost the presidency to Kennedy in 1960, and then he had tried to run for governor of California in 1962, and he had been defeated by Jerry Brown's father. So Nixon then, I think, had I think something happened in his family, a death in the family, but mainly he had a kind of nervous breakdown in 1962-63. However, with the Kennedy assassination, he saw that although 1964 would be impossible, 1968 might be eminently possible for him to make a comeback. So what he did was he went out on the campaign trail And especially after the Goldwater debacle, 64, late 64, 65, 66, 67, and into 68, he would go anywhere. Any Republican organization that wanted to invite him to be the after-dinner speaker, right, out on the rubber chicken circuit, talking to all those, you know, Republican county committee, county executive, Republican state committee man, national committee, all of these people who are not famous and not glamorous, but nevertheless important in the political parties, he would go and cultivate them patiently. And we have the interesting account, right? If you have Norman Mailer in mind, right? Norman Mailer, obviously bombastic, overrated, but still, there's a good piece of writing called Miami and the Siege of Chicago, 1968-1969. The events are in the summer of 1968. I think it was out in 1968. So Miami and the Siege of Chicago. And Norman Mailer is at this reception where the Republican delegates arrive in Miami. And Nixon has a reception for them. So it's Richard Nixon, Pat Nixon, and I'm sure others. And Richard Nixon's goal is to make them feel as important as they felt when they were leaving their hometowns out in rural America, the boonies and so forth, and going to Miami. Because once you get to Miami, right, then there's all this stuff and you might feel a little bit small inside. So he wanted to restore that feeling. And here's how he had won them over. Richard Nixon is known to have spent literally years between 64 and 68 laboring as a Republican after dinner speaker at a myriad of humble events in remote locations. Something he did precisely to get to know local GOP leaders and win them over so they would support him in the future if they were delegates, let's say, to the 1968 convention in Miami. So Mailer is standing there watching these delegates come in and with Nixon, and it's clear to Mailer that he knows a lot of them, maybe most of them, personally. He knows their names. He knows who they are. And here is how Mailer reconstructed what Nixon had done. Now, there's a little bit, you know, it's a historical fiction maybe, but I think it's accurate. So Mailer concluded that Nixon's success with these delegates was the idea that he had gone around half an hour here, an hour there, in conversations which must have wandered so far as the burial specifications of Aunt Mattie in her will and the story of the family stock. Nixon had worked among the despised nuts and bolts of the delegates' hearts. And it showed up here in the skill and the pleasure with which he greeted each separate delegate. Get it? You've got to cultivate these people. It takes years. Trump flies in, flies out, triumph of the will, standing ovation, out, back to Manhattan. So all of this humble work had helped Nixon to fend off challenges from Ronald Reagan, Nelson Rockefeller, George Romney, and others. But Trump doesn't want to do any of that. He wants the triumph of the will. Now, let's see what else we can hope to cover. Just Another sign of a right turn, by the way, from the Clinton faction. Let's not forget old Terry McAuliffe, right? He was their money man 8 years ago. He's been their money man. I'm sure he is still their money man to a significant degree. He's now the governor of Virginia, of course. Terry McAuliffe had come up with a development plan for Northern Virginia. And this was designed to meet the needs of lawyers and businessmen, not so much others. And it would have allowed the lawyers and the businessmen to decide who would get the money. And it's public money. coming into some kind of a public-private partnership, and then the lawyers and the businessmen, not elected representatives, would get to distribute this swag. And that has been shot down, and it has collapsed. And Terry McAuliffe says he's withdrawing his support. Well, he was the architect of this to begin with. So right turn? Here is a right turn concerning the death penalty in Virginia, right? And, you know, I can remember my own personal story at the 1992 Democratic Convention in Manhattan when I tried, together with Robert Fetrakis and others, to force the Democratic Party to have a debate on capital punishment, because we had seen that Bill Clinton was cynically scheduling executions as features of his presidential campaign. He wanted to show what a new Democrat he was. And I said, new Democrat, meaning right-wing, corporate, Wall Street Democrat, not New Deal Democrat, opposite of New Deal Democrat. So Barry Lee Fairchild was a person that that Bill Clinton wanted to execute. So I remember standing a little bit north, on the north side of Madison Square Garden, where the convention was being held, just holding up a big sign that simply said, Barry Lee Fairchild. But we went to federal court, all the way down to Foley Square in Manhattan, to try to get the Democratic Party to respond to signatures from delegates, which we had, and that they should schedule a debate and a vote on the death penalty, that they should be forced to follow their own rules. And of course, what the federal judge told us down there was, this is a private club. You have no ability to influence it. I'm afraid that's a little bit too facile, because there is federal money involved, and civil rights laws would apply, and some of those need perhaps to be construed more broadly in a number of ways. Anyway, Terry McAuliffe on the death penalty. Virginia has been in a situation where they want to execute people using lethal injection. This is a horrible topic, but we have to address it. They wanted to have lethal injections. But, of course, now people in Europe won't have any part of it because of morality and liability. I'm sure a mixture of both. And similarly in the U.S. So now Terry McAuliffe has said that the state law says that you can choose between the electric chair and the lethal injection. What he's saying now is he won't let you choose lethal injection if you know that there are no chemicals there to perform it. He's going to force you to go to the electric chair. So looks like a right-wing angry mood in the Clinton faction. So remember, on Tuesday, vote Bernie, stop Trump. And that goes for every Tuesday from now until the middle of June. And we'll see you on World Crisis Radio.